Eugenie Caron is the daughter of Tom Caron, toy maker, creative genius, award-winning designer, and one of the world's most remarkable inventors. From inventing the brilliant Marble Run, remember that, to the iconic rally chopper bike and the bizarre Bond bug, Tom's designs are cherished the world over. Behind these amazing creations lies an equally remarkable life, which has all been put in a new book called The Toy Maker. And I'm delighted to welcome Eugenie to talk about it this morning. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Wow, what a lovely subject to be talking about. A father who's made toys all his life. Just wonderful, wonderful. But let's start back at the beginning, because his early days were not quite so glamorous, and in fact were quite traumatic, weren't they, in the build-up to the Second World War?
Well, you know, I'd say, you know, from the outside, you'd say it was quite glamorous. He had parents who took them on amazing holidays, flew to the Lido in Venice and went skiing twice a year. But, you know, he was in a Jewish family, not very observant, but Jewish. There was the darkening clouds as it got towards the invasion of Czechoslovakia.
And he, of course, the family moved, and it wasn't a kind of 5-minute job. It was quite an extended period, wasn't it?
They literally fled overnight. My father was woken up a few days before his 13th, no, gosh, I can't remember, 11th or 12th birthday, and literally bundled into the car, the Hispano Suiza. They were all driven to Prague, and they watched the Nazis, they watched them march into Prague from the hotel they were staying at.
Goodness.
Wenceslas Square, yeah.
And then Brussels, Belgium, Nice, France, and finally settling in the UK in 1942.
That's right, yeah.
I'm fascinated that your father studied aircraft engineering at Loughborough University. That was a fabulous thing to be doing, and of course quite a hot topic at the time. I imagine he was quite in demand.
Well, it's kind of, he said to me, I don't think it's gone in the book, but he said to me it was a choice between going down the mines and going into a college course. So,
I'm not sure many miners had that choice, to be fair, but there we go.
Well, exactly, he was always very fascinated by aircraft. He can still recognise, you know, anything that's in the air pretty much. But I think he really struggled with the maths. As I think he says, it's not his strong point. So, you know, and I think what was important about Loughborough was it really gave him some stability. It was, you know, a really nice place for him to be and be with other people. And while his family were kind of going back and forth and going back to Czechoslovakia to try and pick up some pieces, any pieces, he had somewhere that was stable, I suppose.
He became a technical illustrator, and he then ended up at Ford and was there drawing and designing intricate but tiny parts for cars, like a shelf for a glove box or a badge for the bonnet. Was he happy at that job?
I think he found a lot of satisfaction there. He's, you know, details for him are as vital as the whole. You know, you can't have an object that's unresolved. It would really bug him if there was one part of it that's not, as he says, resolved nicely or properly. So it's a very kind of holistic view he has of design. So, you know, a shelf for something is as important as like the grill or the windscreen or the shapes around it.
Fair play.
So I think he found a huge satisfaction in it.
He then had the job that he's probably most revered for. That was heading up the Ogle Design Consultancy from 62 to 99. How did he get that job at that time? What was that all about?
Well, he had worked briefly for Ogle before, and I forget which job he went on to. So he worked there while David Ogle was still there. And then after David Ogle was killed, he was a bit of a maniac driver by all reports, as was my father, actually, to be honest. But Dad was lucky. He only, you know, he managed to survive turning over a car or two.
Goodness.
David Ogle didn't. So he was asked by the chairman to take over the running of Ogle Design.
Amazing. And it wasn't just kind of children's stuff that he was having in his head the time. No, I mean, the Bush TR-130 radio, I'm sure people remember that. The Bond bug, which was a curious creature. I'm not surprised that would turn over, to be fair with you. And the Reliant Scimitar all became into the world because of him and his team. I mean, these are classic things, almost, you know, kind of it's steeped in our history.
Yeah, not to forget, I mean, for Dad, the thing that he'd really like to remember, some of the industrial, the trucks that he did. He was really proud of his trucks and his vans and his commercial vehicles because he felt it was so, well, you know, one of the good things about Dad is his sort of egalitarianism. He was saying, why shouldn't a man who spent, or presumably it was then, mostly men, driving trucks for a living be as comfortable and well-served as someone driving a, you know, a deluxe vehicle, a Jaguar or whatever.
Oh, bless you.
And he designed them and even positioned the window so they were nicely framed. The Renault traffic van, can see that, with that little hump above the cabin.
Yes.
And I think those are the designs he's the most proud of.
Tell us about home life for you as you were growing up as a child then. Kind of paint a picture for us if you can.
There were four of us children. Dad was away a lot. I mean, he was so busy. And it wouldn't be announced. I mean, I would go to the bathroom and notice that his wash bag wasn't there.
Right.
And then I'd know he'd gone off on another trip. So he was like a, yeah, but when he wasn't, you know, when he did come back, it'd take us, we'd do interesting things. Like, again, he had no kind of distinction between the fact, you know, my brothers or I, we'd go to truck races and, you know, derbies and, you know, interesting things, interesting places that might not have occurred to some parents.
And in terms of the house itself, though, I get the impression that now it's just full of stuff of his. Was it like that when you were growing up?
Well, we didn't live in, that's the house that Dad went to after his divorce. So that wasn't the family house. I mean, our house, yeah, he had a room of his own, which was absolutely chock-a-block with stuff. But I think my mother kind of, tried to keep some order in the rest of the place. But yeah, his house is a real expression of his, his brain.
Is he the classic kind of mad inventor?
No, he's not mad at all. Right. He's not as eccentric. I mean, he's very, very, he's very considered. You know, you ask him a question and he'll really think about it.
Right.
I don't see him as eccentric. He's a really clear thinker and a very forward-thinking person. I mean, he's got this nasty habit of getting things right, but 20 years too late, he'll come up with things and you know, it will transpire, but it'll be 20 years after.
Interesting.
He's very good at seeing how things are.
So it's measured rather than anything else. He's not going to come in one day and say, "Oh, I've got this brilliant idea for a fridge that flies and it makes toast at the same time." It's nothing like that. No.
No, as you know, he's very easily considered and sort of methodical in his, you know, sometimes eccentricity, but methodical.
Yeah. The book's called Toymaker, and that's really what he his kind of joy, I guess. And for the rest of us as well, I mean, we are talking here of things which really are steeped in the history of Great Britain and our childhood. The Marble Run was one that many people may have forgotten. That was sold to Kiddycraft back in 1970. For those that don't remember that was awesome, wasn't it? The Marble Run.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, you say people have forgotten, but you know, you say it to anybody, and they immediately light up, and it's lovely.
Yeah,
yeah, he's incredibly, incredibly proud, and it was because my aunt gave us a wooden version, and Dad, you know, being typical Dad, was like, it only does one thing. What if you could build the things? And he started working on that because it was
wonderful.
A fixed model, and that's how that transpired. It was a present from my aunt, and that. Yeah, inspired that. And yeah, he was always making stuff for us, which was, again, one of our great bonuses. He had this whole design, this whole workshop that you could get anything made.
Oh,
so
how
he was brilliant for that.
Oh, wonderful. And we cannot not mention something that had such fond memories for me and many boys of my era, the Rally Chopper. And that had a kind of problem surrounding it, didn't it? He had come of his joy taken away because of a dispute about its origin.
Yeah, that was a funny one. I was first alerted to that. There was a BBC programme back in, gosh, when was it? It must have been about 2004, 2005.
Right.
And they attributed to the Rally Man. And I wrote to them. I was like, are you sure about this? Anyway, so it all kind of went kicked off from there. But, you know, the Design Council have attributed it to Dad now, officially.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was a bit of an odd one.
Yes, Alan Oakley it was, the then chief of design for Rally, maintained until his death that it was him who designed the bike. But your father and Ogle were eventually credited, as you say, with the invention by the Design Council. So fair play.
Yeah. And his wife, yeah, I saw this video, this documentary recently about Rally. And, yeah, she survived him. And she still has this sort of one envelope that has got a vague drawing of a what looks a bit like a chopper on it, and that's the myth of it. And, you know, Dad can present, you know, any amount of his amazing sketchbooks full of the
Amazing.
It's baffling, but anyway, that's how it is.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, those sketchbooks must be incredible to look back over and see the wondrous creations that are in them.
Yeah, they're great. I mean, and the lovely thing for us is they're all held, well, I think most of them, not all, are at the V&A. So when things go back to normal, they're publicly accessible. So anyone can go and sort of request these sketchbooks and leave through them, because they're wonderful. You know, they're an eclectic mixture of, you know, like you said, he could be designing a truck one day and then he could be doing a banjo for my sister another day, and it'll all be on the same page. So,
oh, fantastic.
They're brilliant.
He famously said that he failed to persuade Matchbox and Airfix that they were ignoring girls, which is quite interesting.
Yeah, no, as I say, you know, I wouldn't go as far as to say he's completely he's feminist, but, you know, he was much more forward thinking than an equivalent man of his time, I would have thought.
Yeah.
And he really felt that they were missing a trick and ignoring, you know, 50% of the population.
Well, absolutely. Well, so, the first of those who went bust, and the second one turned their attention to a collector's market. So he's absolutely right, wasn't he?
Yeah, no. As I say, you know, that's Dad being 20 years ahead of his time again.
Yeah. And now, of course, electronic toys are the kind of thing. It's a very, very different world now. Everything's designed to be discarded and replaced, isn't it?
Yeah. I think he hasn't really... Yeah, that sort of troubles him, I think. Yeah, he's still very much a lover of the wooden toy and the thing that you can hold.
Imagine it's a very confusing world to be in when you're kind of used to doing the kind of stuff that he did, and now we've got people obsessed with, you know, iPads and stuff like that. It's just not the same, is it?
Well, he quite enjoys his iPad.
What a shame we didn't invent that, eh?
Well, yeah, that would have been.
Oh, wonderful. Well, it's a lovely, lovely book. There's loads more detail in there, obviously. It's called The Toy Maker. Eugenie, it's been lovely to talk to you today. Really appreciate your time on the show.
Thanks.